thank you, thank you, thank you very much. At last, I'm part of it all. Oh, dear. Yes, hello, Edinburgh. Or at least a very select part of it, yeah. It's my first time here. I arrived yesterday, and it was astonishing that for the second time in my life, I quickly became aware of the enormous power that good old-fashioned live entertainment can generate. In the case of the festival, it's a power magnetic enough to attract eager pilgrims from all over the world. I say for the second time because it's a situation that reminds me of... Did you hear that subtle introduction of the title of this very show? the skill of the man. It reminds me of the very first time I encountered the magic of live theatre. It was a long time ago in the 40s, 1940s, when my mother thought it was time I was introduced to some proper grown-up stuff, and she took me to a production of Richard III in the West End of London, starring Laurence Olivier. And I'd never seen this. I didn't know the play, I hadn't read it, and at that time, had I read it, I wouldn't have understood more than about 10% of it. But it didn't matter. Because what happened there on that stage was to influence me for the rest of my life. I was knocked out by this immense spectacle, the energy, the vitality, the charisma, and of the star itself, his villainy and his comedy. It was an astonishing experience for me, and I thought that really cemented my idea as to what I was going to be. I thought, yeah, I'm not just going to be an actor, I'm going to be Laurence Olivier. It's going to be great. So how to persuade my mother to put me on the stage? I come from a fairly artistic family. My grandfather was a novelist, my uncle was a sculptor, his wife's an artist, my father played the cello, and my mother was a keen diarist and wrote a lot of poetry. So I thought, yes, I will persuade her that I too have these artistic genes. I'm a sensitive creature, creative, and have so much to give to the world that I must do this. I cannot possibly dirty my hands by being a builder or a doctor or a lawyer or anything like that. And unfortunately, she fell for this. My father had unfortunately died a few years before during the war, so she was struggling to keep body and soul together for the family. And he would have knocked the nonsense out of me and told me to get a job. But no, my mother understood, and she said, yes, if you finish your education, I'll send you, or try and send you, scrape up the money to send you to a drama school. And that's what happened. I went to drama school for two terms, only two terms. At the end of that, I gave up because, for two reasons, I couldn't have my mother paying out another 17 guineas a term. That's £17, a lot of money in those days. And the main reason was is that were not telling me what I wanted to know. I mean, they were teaching me stupid things like diction and voice production and movement, dancing, improvisation, history of the theatre, all that rubbish. No, all I wanted to know about is how to cope with mass adulation, sign a lot of autographs, and get some advice on real estate in Beverly Hills. And I had a master plan. All I would do, in fact, is to try and get a job. And I did. I managed to get the lowliest of low jobs as assistant stage manager in a little theatrical company in Bexhill-on-Sea. You see, the carrot to this job, although it was meant sweeping the stage, making the tea, looking after the actors, ordering the wigs and the costumes, all this kind of stuff, the carrot to the job for me was the possibility that I might get a few parts during the season which would not be filled by the regular members of the company. And when that happened, I would write to the studios and they would no doubt send a talent scout from Hollywood, 6,000 miles, nothing much, and come and see me being brilliant as a schoolboy, whatever, and thrust a 7-year contract to MGM into my hands, and off I went. Well, I'm still waiting, I have to tell you. However, the joy of being in weekly rep, which is what it was, which meant that they put on a different production every week. It's hard going. You see, you're performing one play in the evening, a couple of matinees maybe, you have Sunday off, and during the day, you're already preparing, rehearsing the production for the following week, which would open on the following Monday. As an ASM, particularly if I was given an odd part, which I was, I mean, I was rushing around. You can imagine the pace of getting the props together, ordering the wigs and the stuff like that, and then on the Monday, polishing it all, sending it back to the local antique dealer or something who'd lent us the stuff in return for a couple of complimentaries. So it was rough going. And I soon learned that there was one attribute that was absolutely vital in weekly rep, and that was an immense, inexhaustible, unlimited, cornucopial amount of talent, which, of course, I had. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't mean talent for acting. That was quite useful, but hardly a priority. No, no, no. What I mean is a talent for being able to do without food and sleep for days on end, because there was just no time for wimpish luxuries like that. Because I was faced with the reality of the theatre. Here were people who had to really get on with it very fast, had to learn their lines very fast, had a great skill in doing that. They produced a performance, however good or bad it was, within a week. It demanded a huge amount of discipline. And my immediate boss, the stage manager, was very good at that. He taught me really to get myself together and knocked 90% of the nonsense out of me. I'm glad to say I still retain 10% because I think it's very useful as an actor to have some nonsense in you. And I was also put among people who knew their stuff. Some of it knew it very badly. I mean, there's some rotten actors there, but you learn from them. And some very experienced older ones. I remember one guy who had actually worked with Henry Irving himself. I mean, this took me really back because my mother had also given me a biography of Henry Irving. So I admired the man, never having seen him. He died in 1905, but he was the first actor to be knighted, right? With a couple of taps of the royal sword on his shoulders, he lifted the entire profession into a level of, well, near respectability. And this man had actually worked with him. It was wonderful to see this. But what was he doing in Weekly Rep? He'd had a distinguished career, and as so often happens, you know, you get your sell-by date, you have to make do with really roughing it in Weekly Rep. So he was a bit, well, dare I say bitter? Yes, I suppose he was, because he'd hoped for better things. And he was always very rude about the audiences. I couldn't understand it. He would come off cursing the audience. Oh, what a rotten audience. Never used to be like this in the old days. Oh, no, no, it is. Filthy people. I wish they were all dead. Very crabby. And I asked him one day, do you hate every audience? He said, well, I do nowadays, yes. not what they were, not in the old days. Oh, Irving wouldn't have an audience like that. Oh, terrific people, wonderful people. And I asked him, do you have a favourite audience? Yes, I have. I've got a very favourite audience. My favourite audience is being at home alone in front of a mirror. Now, I hoped to see a twinkle in his eye, but you know there wasn't one. So I asked him also, he was very nice to the fans outside the stage door. I said, well, you seem to like your fans very much. You think they're all right, do you? Oh, yes, I like my fans. I think fans are wonderful. Because, you know, you have to remember that a fan is always there to remind an actor that he's not alone in the way he thinks about himself. Man was crazy. That period where I started learning about the disciplines, as I say, of the theatre, I tended to put behind me all these dreams, these nonsense dreams of Hollywood and so on, and really did enjoy it so much. But I had a particular attraction for these actor laddies of long ago. But some of them are very sad, these stories. And I remember this guy from Irving, he said the old type actors in the olden days, late 90s, if they were known for particular roles, they would have those roles at the tips of their fingers or tips of their tongue, really, and they would make guest appearances all around the country to perform the role for which they'd become famous. And they would drag their costumes in a big hamper behind and makeup and so on, and turn up at the stage door just a couple of hours before the show, because he'd sent ahead his requirements for doing whatever play they were going to do that night, and the company would rehearse without him. They knew roughly the moves they had to make, because we're all standard productions. Basically, if you have a star, he takes center stage, and everybody would sort of stand around him, supporting him. So they knew what to do. But these guys, these bold, brash guys would come, these actors would come to the stage door, really with only two questions in their mind at the stage door. They'd say, where's the stage, and what's the play? And they'd just kind of get on with it, you see. There's a wonderful poem, there's a guy called Billy Bennett. He was a music hall entertainer, and he wrote these wonderful monologues. I'll recite this one to you, because it's about actors. It goes like this. I'm cherishing a secret in my bosom about the dreadful stage life that I lead. I've heard it said that pros are decent people, but according to the papers that I read, both actresses and actors are dead wrong-uns, whether from the palace or the hippodrome. You folks out here know I'm an actor. But I never breathe a word of it at home. Because my mother doesn't know that I'm an actor. It would break her poor old heart if she found out. She knows I'm a deserter from the Scottish Fusiliers. She knows I stole a blind man's can. That got me 7 years. She knows I'm connected to a gang of West End pests, and the police have had me twice inside the cage. She knows I mix with ladies who've had a shady past, but my mother doesn't know I'm on the stage. Sometimes she sees the powder on my clothing, and then it's such a nuisance to explain. If she thought it was powder, she would shoot me. So, of course, I have to tell her it's cocaine. Thank you very much. Thank you. You know, then as now, it's pretty desperate to make a living at all. I've been very lucky over the years. There's a story of two old actors meeting in the Charing Cross Road, the centre of the West End Theatre, and also the home of many of the agents there. And one said to the other, "Oh, dear Cyril, how nice to see you again. Oh, you're looking terribly down in the mouth. What is, you're right." And the fellow said, "Yes, I'm fine, thank you very much." "Oh, dear, are you resting, Cyril?" "Well, yes, I'm afraid I am resting." "Oh, that's too bad, too bad. Anything in view?" No, I'm afraid not. No, I haven't got anything in view." "Oh, my goodness me. How long have you been resting for?" "Oh, I haven't had a job for, what is it now? I think next week it's 6 years." "Oh, my dear chap, I am so sorry. 6 years without a job. Tell me, Cyril, have you ever thought of taking up another profession?" "What? And give up the theatre?" All this joy of rep. You see, I was in the tail end of that romantic period of theatre before television came along and changed everything. And my career, theatrical career, was interrupted because I had to have 2 years in the army as a conscript. And I thought, me, a sensitive artiste in the army, oh, no, like, be a soldier, no, carry guns, much too heavy. And I told the sergeant this, and the recruiting sergeant, or the one who was issuing the jobs, the trades, "Do you want to be a driver, a vehicle mechanic, signaller, artificer? What do you want to do?" I said, "Well, I really want to join the entertainments branch because I don't think I'd be happy as anything else." Well, this sergeant was, of course, extremely concerned about my happiness. they tried to make a man of me, but failed and made me an orderly room clerk instead. Which meant keeping a very low profile. And I spent 2 years there. And it was in the tank regiment. And the tank regiment was a really butch regiment. Well, I did achieve some distinction, I have to say, in the tank regiment, because I was the only soldier at the time, over the 2 years, in the regiment who never once went inside a tank. Didn't get a medal for it, but I was awfully proud of myself. And when I came out, I went back to rep for quite a long while, improving my skills, I hope. And, you know, those days of rep were the best apprenticeship I could have had. The experience they gave us, the disciplines they taught, and the disasters they sometimes threw at us have been of enormous value to me, and I shall never regret those early times. Well, anyway, after about 25 years of learning my craft, doing a lot of comedy, farce, West End tours, all that, I was working with a guy called John Cleese. They made films for management training. And during the course of one of these, we got on very well. During the course of this, he said he and his then-wife, Connie Booth, had written a series, or at least a pilot, called Fawlty Towers, about a hotel. And he thought I might be quite nice as the Spanish waiter. I said, "Well, how nice of you. Thank you very much." I said, "But do you think you could make him a German waiter? Because I can't do a Spanish accent." And he actually listened. He listened to me. This is his great skill. He always listens and then rejects. not always, by any means, not always. He said, "No, I think we'll leave him Spanish." I mean, can you imagine Manuel as a German waiter? Nothing would go wrong in the place, would it? He'd run it. So, and that's what came about. Now, the thing about this German-Spanish thing, I said German accent, can I do a German accent? Because I come from Germany. I'm actually from Berlin. And we as a family were refugees just before the war, because it so happened that my father was Jewish, which was not at all a good thing to be in the 1930s. And things got very sticky for him. He was, in fact, arrested in the September of 1938. But fortunately, because he had some influence through his business connections with a high-up chief of police there, who, at great risk to his own job, I should think, got him released. And my dad went over to England. He was sponsored here, given a job, so he was allowed to come in. And we were okay, my mother, an Aryan. We three kids were mongrels, half-breeds, if you like, but not in danger at that time. We followed on a few weeks later. You know, Germany has always remained in my psyche, my consciousness, because I still have relatives there on my mother's side, none of my father's side, of course. And I've often been asked why I did so much comedy, because Germans aren't known for their sense of humor. There is a certain amount of truth in it, all these stereotypes, there's a grain of truth. And I certainly remember, I had an uncle who was a Prussian, North German, who I never saw him smile. Nice man, very nice man, but very German. And as a boy of six or so, I tried to make him laugh once, and he didn't react at all. And he looked at me rather sternly, shaking his head, and he took me on his knee, wanted to give me a little lecture. And he said, "Now, Andreas," my real name is Andreas, you see, "Andreas, I want to tell you something. We Germans may have many faults, but I am happy to say that a sense of humor is not among them." So when I came to England, first time, after a serious life, because one day my school friend, I mean, I knew nothing about anti-Semitism or anything about this. In fact, I considered myself a communist. I preferred Stalin to Hitler because he had a bigger moustache. And I had a friend, a school friend, best friend, Ralph, who one day came to me and he said, "I'm not allowed to play with you anymore." I said, "Well, really, why?" He said, because your father's a Jew. And I couldn't follow that. I did. Why? What's the matter with that? He said, "Well, Jews don't like Hitler very much, and that's why I can't play with you." And I really couldn't see the logic of this, and neither could he, because I could have understood if he'd been forbidden to play with my father. But why me, you see? He didn't understand, I didn't understand, but the fact is that we never played together. These sort of things were edging into life and not very pleasant. So anyway, we came over to England, and where I first learned about the absurdity of life, that everything in life is absurd if you look at it from a certain angle. And my first example of this was having arrived at Southampton on a big liner. We stayed the night there in a little hotel prior to going to London and were greeted in the morning at breakfast with a plate of shredded wheat. It's a domed heap of hay. I mean, I'd never seen this before, nor had any of my mother and brother and sister, nothing. And we didn't know what to do with it. So my mother thought, well, can't ask questions, you know, we are foreigners here, nobody's telling us anything, so we better eat it. So she munched into this heap of hay and said, "Oh, it's lovely." And so we followed suit, not knowing, of course, at that time that you put milk and sugar with it. And it was curious that nobody told us that's what you know. This is the standoffish, you know, we don't do that in England, who knows? Well, stiff upper lip, let them get on with it. But I learned to love England very much. But of course, I had to learn the language as well. Because I only had one sentence. When I came over to England, I had to say, I'm sorry, I do not understand you. I'm a little German boy. Yes, you may well have. Well, of course, I stopped saying it. As soon as I knew what I was saying, I stopped saying it because I thought I was a big German boy, you see. But it made me learn it all the quicker. And at that age, I was coming up to 9. I was young enough to learn the language without leaving a foreign accent. At least I think I haven't. I get away with English now. If you leave it a few years longer, you're likely to be left with some continental tang, which, had I become an actor, would have severely limited me and my choice of roles. I would only have been able to play, you know, foreign parts. So I'm thankful to Hitler for one thing, that he sent me over early. So I could manage to have a decent career here and a real life here. So I learned the language beautifully and did a lot of work in particularly radio, one of my favorite mediums. I was particularly suitable for radio because it enabled me to play tall, good-looking men. And my voice, too, had become a beautiful organ. After radio, and in radio, too, and television, everywhere after that, I had learned the language so well that I was soon offered parts of a Turkish carpet salesman, a Russian spy, Japanese prisoner of war, Italian hairdresser, and a Spanish waiter, of course, Spanish waiter. Well, we come back to Fawlty Towers. Everything always comes back to Fawlty Towers. In 1970, we'd made 12 episodes, that's all, 12 half-hour episodes. We made six of them in 1975, and the other six in 1979. 75 was a very good year for me. I had my own play that I'd written on at the Chichester Festival. I was starring in the West End in a play where I was breaking my neck every night, in a play called No Sex, Please, We're British, where I was playing the Michael Crawford part, where you know the kind of acrobatics he gets up to. I had to be very fit. And so we recorded that series of 40 Towers on a Sunday, because that's the only day I had off. And I'd been used to falling about and knocking myself about and escaping uninjured for most of the time. But as far as 40 Towers are concerned, there are three questions I'm always asked. Number one, what's it like working with John Cleese? Number two, are there going to be any more? And number three, did it hurt? The answer to the questions. One, it's wonderful working with John and the whole cast, in fact. He was a very good father, if you like, father figure of the group, as was the director as well. And it was a little family. It was a great team. We were very close together during that period. And it was an open team. In other words, we were encouraged to make our own contributions to, if we didn't think something was funny, we'd say it. And maybe the joke would be improved, whatever. And John himself is a extremely sensitive man. Sensitive not just to his own feelings, but to the feelings of those around him. I mean, I wouldn't like to get on the wrong side of him, I have to say. But he is very supportive and a very loving man. So we got on terribly well. So it was great working with John. Are there going to be any more? No, I don't think so. I mean, I've dyed my hair grey, as you say. And we've all got a bit older. I don't think we could do it. There are still spin-offs being considered and so on. Oh, and I'm also reminded of the first series was bought by a German TV company who were going to make a German, not a German version, but they were going to just revoice it, German actors dubbing the words. And they knew I came from Germany, so would I go over to Munich to dub myself into German with a Spanish accent? Pure guesswork on my part. Anyway, I did it. And the interesting thing is, I say the first series, but they only took the first five episodes. The episode they didn't want in Germany was the one about the... That was there. No, they're showing that German episode nowadays, and I think it gets a few laughs. Yes, the third one. Did it hurt? Sometimes. Well, nothing much. It was very carefully rehearsed. And when he knocks me about, or when I have my head hit against the wall or whatever, provided we were well rehearsed, and we timed it right, and we knew our stuff, I mean, we knew what we were doing, it didn't hurt. There was one occasion, I have to say, because I always considered it his fault. I met him for dinner the other day. He said, you know, we should really check our stories because I don't agree with you, Andrew. So we're going to get together and hammer it out. Not entirely his fault. He has to, in one episode, hit me over the head with a frying pan. I don't know if any of you ever saw that. He thinks I'm a burglar and he hits me. Well, this had to be carefully rehearsed because he approaches me from behind and in the dark of the hotel lobby, and not knowing who I am, hits me, see? This was rehearsed so that he would approach me, then stop the punch, pull his punch, as it were, a quarter of an inch before he hit my head. Carefully timed, because I had my back to him. I had to time it so that I had to know exactly when that would happen, so it would coincide with my falling down on the deck. And we did that beautifully. And on the night, he did it beautifully, but it was the end of a long day, and the only thing he forgot was this quarter of an inch. So it went whack onto my head. And as I went down, hit the deck, I thought to myself, I'm so glad this is the last shot of the show because I can't get up again. And I learned afterwards that there were two frying pans. These were stainless steel frying pans, I think, big heavy ones. And one of them had got padding. So just in case he missed, it wouldn't hurt. But for some reason, he'd been given the wrong one. You see. I didn't know this about 4 years. And I was told that, yes, it was the wrong one, and it actually dented the pan. My head being solid didn't matter, you know, it was all right. But I thought it was his fault entirely. And I said to him afterwards, I said, you know, that was a bit much. You know, you hit me this hard. We did rehearse it, and it's a bit, you know, it hurt. I didn't think he noticed it, you see. He said, what's the matter with you, Andrew? I mean, we're not doing a show in the West End, a long run. You're doing it once in your life. Pull yourself together. Get on with it. And he bought me another baby sham. But no, I made it clear to him that I was a bit miffed about it and that I was quite angry. But nice man that he is, he forgave me. So in radio, it's a medium I've always loved. I still love it. I still do it, thank heavens. And I wrote a lot of plays for it. But one of the things that disturbed me was people talk too much on radio. They never stop saying words. And the writing, too, the plays I had to do, had too many words. with dialogue like, "My darling, don't you look lovely coming through that door wearing your green hat? What have you got in your left hand? It's a gun. My God, why are you pointing it at me?" It's kind of a tired old word. In fact, Timothy West wrote a wonderful play just full of that sort of dialogue. Great stuff. And I thought to myself, well, since radio is a medium not just of words but of sound, why can't we tell some of the story? Write a play, tell some of the story at least without words, just with sound effects and so on. Sound effects that are not ambiguous, that are very clear what they mean. And then I thought, well, why not try one without any words at all? Could I do it? And I did. I wrote a 20-minute play on this. The play is called The Revenge, only two words in it. It is presumably the story of a man who escapes from prison and seeks his revenge on the bloke who shopped him and got him there, and who's quite willing to give himself up afterwards. And it did very well for me because it won an award in, of all places, Barcelona. So everything leads back to Barcelona and Manuel. And I'll just finish now because with two little stories that demonstrates that in my career, for the general public, all they know about is Fawlty Towers. All they want to know about is Fawlty Towers. And I can talk about anything else, but they glaze over, really, on the whole. But two little examples of this is exemplified by two cases. I was in a play in the West End called, I bet you know it, Jumpers, Tom Stoppard. Highly intellectual, difficult, difficult play, funny as well. We had a great cast, sell out for 6 months. Who was in it? Felicity Kendall, Timothy Bates and Simon Goodell, Paul Ennington and me. Wonderful intellectual treat. And afterwards, one evening, I came out, people looking for autographs, and there was a couple from, I don't know where, had come down to London to see the play. The lady said, "Oh, Mr. Sachs, I want to tell you what a lovely performance. Thank you so much. It was really nice." I said, "Thank you very much." And her husband backed her up on that. "Yes, it was great. Really good. Very, very good indeed. Great praise." I said, "Wonderful. I'm so glad you came. Do you have nice seats?" And she said, "Oh, no, we don't mean Jumpers. We mean Fawlty Towers." 2.5 hours of Stoppard, and that's all they think about. And the other story is I was in Oxford Street some months ago, and a man approached me. Nothing to do with the theatre, of course. He happened to recognise me, and he wanted my autograph, and was very surprised to learn that it was 25 years ago and that there were only 12 episodes. And he looked really shocked. He said, "25 years ago?" I said, "Yes." He said, oh, dear, he said. He put his hand solicitously on my arm, and he said, "How have you managed since then?" Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you.